Okay, we do have a speaker tonight. It falls on me to introduce them. This young woman started coming to our meetings a little while ago. No, it was a short while ago, and so kind of got involved and doing a bit of service and all that kind of good stuff. Don't know much about them particularly. Little bits and pieces that we've heard and having chats after the meetings and stuff like that, which is always good. So I'm really looking forward to what she's got to share. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Fiona, who's going to share her experience, strength and hope with us, journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous. She did celebrate a pretty significant milestone in recovery recently, so I'll leave it to her to share that. So 45 minutes, whatever you're comfortable with, Fiona, the floor is yours. Please jump in and share with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, everybody. It's so nice to be here in Higna meeting with you all. I am celebrating my second year in recovery in the Narcotics Anonymous program. And I've been asked to share my journey. So without ado, I would basically...
Hi, Fiona.
Hi, everybody. I'd like to begin in stages. So in the beginning, as a child, then as a young adult in England, and then I moved to France and I started another whole new life after that. So it's going to be kind of broken up into about three stages. So in the beginning, I was a very well-loved young child. I had a father who doted on me, which was lovely. There was nothing that I couldn't do to get what I wanted. You know, if my mum said, no, you can't have it, well, then I'd just go and see my dad and he'd say, well... So I felt very spoiled as a little girl. And... unbeknown to me, my mother and father's social life became a little bit hot in the neighborhood, and they kind of got the finger pointed at them for being socially unacceptable. This was when we lived in Essex, and I lived there till I was about 10, and so we got a bit ostracized by the neighbors. And mum and dad had to move, and I didn't really know why. I just thought they said, well, you know, we want to move near Nottingham, which is for my mum to be closer to her mother. So we moved to Lincolnshire when I was 10 years old. And in Lincolnshire, I realised that, you know, my dad had his own business, and we worked for him. He sold toys and fancy goods. And he spent a lot of time in warehouses negotiating business talk with people and getting prices for toys. And we had toys in our house like all the time when I was young. And so there again, you know, I was never deprived of anything I wanted. I had to work for it. We did shows and fairs and cat shows and dog shows and local festivals. He worked for Shell and, you know, big companies like British Oxygen Company. They'd have their annual event, you know, and we'd go with the stall and we'd stand behind the stall, my brother and I, my mum and my dad. And we worked as a family. You know, we had this very close knit. We loaded the car, we unloaded it. We took all the prize tickets off all the toys at Christmas. Our home was full of toys, because mum and dad had wrapped them, and then they'd take them to the evening event, you know, for BOC, for example, and we'd get invited to the show. So, you know, I lived in this wonderful, magical, theatrical, covered in toys, fancy world, where we all had to work hard. You know, we learned that what you put in, you got out. And we had a family home without TV, so we all sat in chairs in the evening and we all read books together, all four of us, and we played the board games that my father sold, and we had this very tight connection, and all was good. until my dad decided that he would start cutting costs and make his own beer at home. And so the beer became quite a big thing, and we'd have demijohns in the airing cupboard, like bubbling away. The whole house smelt of yeast, and then dad'd have his bottling days, and they would do trips to France, they do a booze cruise, and I'd go with them and stuff. And there was always like tons of alcohol at home, always. It was part of our daily consummation. And from quite young, I kind of joined in. I started with the sherry at dinner time on a Sunday when my mum was cooking the dinner, and I finally ended up raiding, the drinks cabinet when they weren't looking. And then my dad ended up getting into the wine circle, and he ended up making wine for competition, and that was a biggie as well. It was a big consuming part of their lives. They were out doing the wine circle evenings and doing the competitions, and dad making the stuff and filling up the garage. And he made a huge wine rack on just one side of the wall, and we had like we had elderflower champagne bottles exploding when we were like all sitting in the living room reading, and it was like, hell, there's another bottle gone. And that's how we lived, we had this like alcohol heaven at home. And so they kind of they worked nights, the pair of them. My mum was a nurse, she worked nights, and my dad worked shifts. He worked two nights, two weeks day and 2 weeks night. So for two weeks on, consecutive months, I used to have 2 weeks at night on my own at home. And so, I'd got into having a drink, and I used to kind of, get more of that, I suppose. And by this time, when they could leave me on my own, I was old enough to stay at home with my brother, and so we must have been about 12, 14, something like that. And I was babysitting. I was the only babysitter in the village. And so, I had my own life. I had my own life. Drink alcohol too. I could get it when they weren't there. I didn't have to have permission. I was babysitting, and I was full-time school. I was, doing the right things, passing my exams and stuff like that. And I started noticing as I was getting a bit older that they would like punish me and send me to my room frequently, and it was kind of a bit uncanny. It was like, wait a minute, that's not normal. I wonder why they're doing that. So I started jotting it down. One New Year's Eve, I got a piece of paper out, and I hate her and I hate him. And I recorded like every time that they sent me up to my room, which I thought was like, unjustified. And I calculated, and it felt like in secret I was observing my parents from a distance, thinking there's something not right here. I can't put my finger on it, but it just doesn't feel right. There's something that just doesn't, spiritually, it didn't feel right, and I started having this secret kind of it was a release for me to just go and jot this little marker down, on my list. That was how I handled the rejection. And it became so frequent that I could eventually just go scooching around the house, do what I wanted to do. They were in the front room, I'd been sent to my room, my brother was out doing. And I developed a complete secret life on my own with them being in the same building. Basically, they would consume, have their drinks in the front room, and we'd finally got a TV, and they sat watching TV, and I would steal bottles of wine from the garage, and I would go up to my room, and it became a challenge to myself. I wanted to see how, this sensation of being drunk, could go, how far could I go with it, basically, you know, I gave myself a challenge. And so it ended up, I ended up at sort of like 16 years old, probably consuming like a whole bottle of homemade extra strong wine by myself every night. Every night, you know, the compulsion and the obsession was just full on. It was already, it had already started with stealing chocolates and stealing money and rooting around looking for answers. What's going on? What is this thing that I can't put my finger on? It just feels uncomfortable. It doesn't feel like everything's just, you know, it feels unjust. I wanted to know what was happening and I couldn't find out what it was, you know, and I kept snooping around and I'd find money. And so that's how I lived. I had this secret life, and my parents never once came into my room, ever. So, you know, that was it. I could just do what I wanted. So I got a boyfriend, my first boyfriend at 16, and he's like, I'll take you to the pub. And I'm like, yeah, okay, let's go to the pub. And he said, I don't want you to, like, you know, be bothered by alcohol. You can have a half a bit of shandy. No, it was a half a bit of Tops. That was it. And I remember sitting in this bar, like, you know, at 16 with my new boyfriend. And he didn't realise that I was a massive drinker, you know, that I was, like, blasting my brains to pieces at home, you know, every night of the week that I had been doing for God knows how long. And these being all sweet and lovely. And I never told him, it never occurred to me to tell anybody until I got, you know, anywhere near recovery. So then, yeah, pub life began after that and in England, and it was just a challenge to get drunk every single day. That was all. It was just like massively fun. I had a bunch of friends who all did the same thing. All of us went down the pub every single night, at like Monday to Saturday to Sunday, you know, and I lived in Peterborough. Fast, it was banging headaches the next day and swearing I'd never. And then at 19, I had a boyfriend introduced. Well, I had one of the lads in our village, in our town. Everyone was talking about drugs. It was like, whoa. And I was like, whoa, that's scary. That's really scary. That's not up my street at all. But I got really curious. And so I ended up going out with this lad, and he introduced me to hashish. So I ended up getting alcohol and hash, like, you know, on a parallel. And they both went together. There was no differentiation between the two. It had to be both together. And there it was. That was it. That was like the beginning of my introduction into the drug world and the other people's houses and seeing what other people did and, you know, it all being underground and it RI and Jar and going to concerts and swearing that it was going to be something we'd be doing till we were 60 years old and, you know, we were going to die doing it. And Pink Floyd were out bringing out wonderful records, and I used to get, you know, my stuff, and on a Monday or a Wednesday I used to have the day off at the hairdressing salon. I'd started hairdressing by this time. Before I started the drugs, I was hairdressing, and you know, I absolutely loved it. And I was a good dancer. I passed all my, I was an achiever, you know, I passed all my British Ballet Organisation dancing certificates with honours. And, you know, I was a good little student. And as soon as, like, you know, in the hairdressing salon, people started talking about the Queen, and I got all kind of anti-system and like anarchistic. And, oh man, I wrecked my apprenticeship. You know, I was in my third year of my 3-year apprenticeship, and one day I just like freaked out. And it was so unlike me to have a bad attitude. You know, I was always the compassionate one at home. Whenever there was a gang of either my mum and my brother together, or my dad and my dad and my mum against us two, or, you know, I just couldn't bear sending anybody to Coventry. I used to all and join the, you know, the downtrodden one. And so, you know, I was surprised myself, to be quite honest. I really surprised myself that I'd got so much anger and jealousy. And this girl, you know, had helped me through my 3-year apprenticeship, and she taught me so much. And we built up a salon together, and it was just a beautiful thing. And I just wrecked it. I just, like, you know, they took me out of the place and they put me in the mother's little salon to finish my apprenticeship and get rid of me. And that was the start of, like, yeah, drugs ruining my life for me, basically. This attitude that had come in that was just so foreign to me. Ended up being a bane, you know, for the rest of my life. I was easily rubbed up the wrong way, you know. And so my hairdressing then took me into a Sicilian salon in Peterborough, and my boss was smoking as well, and he'd give me little bits at the end of the work day, and I just ended up, like, being hooked. It was more important than going down the pub. It was like a whole different lifestyle. It was, you know, it was like psychedelic, and it was like a different type of music, and it was, you know, a whole different branch from my disco persona. You know, I became a minority, really. It was not easy to get hold of. You had to do stuff. You had to go knock on people's doors, and the fear of rejection and people to say, no, sorry, we've got nothing. And me thinking, oh, man, I'm just so dependent on other people, you know, whereas before in the pubs, everybody was there. So it started being a bit annoying, and me thinking, what the hell? So I met a dealer, it was one night, at a party, and I'd taken myself on holiday, and I'd got my Jack Russell with me, and my sixth sense was screaming at me. There was this person who everybody was, like, butterflying over, this person, and wow, and the strange hair he had, and the strange long fingernails he had, and, you know, the psychedelic outfit, and the broken teeth and stuff. And my sixth sense was yelling at me as loud as it could to say, stay away from this person, stay away from it. And so, of course, you know, I'd got into being rebellious, and I'd got into being contradictory, and, you know, self-willed, and decided, yeah, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to do the opposite of what, you know, my inner voice, psychopath, boyfriend, drug dealer, who just brought me to hell, basically. That's all I can say. I had a taste of hell. I've never wanted to kill anybody in my life, but there I was at a stage where I just wanted to kill. I'd never felt how deep a human being could go, you know. Well, maybe you don't know, but this visit to hell, after the violence that I'd suffered, was extremely philosophical. I don't regret having experienced it, because all I can think is that it was an enlightenment, basically, of something that I just never ever want to repeat. But it's also added to my compassion and my empathy towards people that do suffer. And I got picked up by my friends and taken to their place and looked after, and they were the people that introduced me to France. We came over grape picking together at 1 year, and I just felt I'd fallen in love with this place. I decided this is where I wanted to live, where I live now. So I managed to find somebody who wanted to run away from England with a guitar. I wanted to run away from England. I couldn't cope with life. I was having panic attacks. I was in a relationship with another drug user who saved my life, who managed to get me out of my agoraphobia. You know, I was so scared to go outside that I couldn't even open the door and walk down the street by myself. I was just absolutely terrified. This life in hell just absolutely crippled me. So I had 2 years with this lad who was who still remains one of my best people that I've ever had in my life. Even though he's an active drug user. brought me back to life, basically. Yeah, he did. So we spent 24 hours together. We lived together. We worked together. We did the same shifts. We were working in factories. We cooked together. We bathed together. We cleaned our teeth together. And surprisingly enough, all this time I spent 24 hours with this guy, he still managed to use. He was a heroin addict. He still managed to use without me noticing. He kept everything from me. He had this double life. And so I find out one day that it was absolutely true. And I got myself a job on a cruise ship. I went to an agency in London and I got myself this wonderful job. I went back to the hairdressing salons that I used to work in previously, that unfortunately had had to get rid of me while I was with the psychopath, because I was in no fit state to be working. I wasn't turning up for work. I just couldn't, you know, keep it together. And I got this job on the cruise ship. And of course I got on there and said to myself, just avoid everybody that does drugs. Just like behave yourself. You know what you got to do. You know what you're not supposed to do. Just don't do it, okay? And I had this wonderful cruise booked for 9 months, working in the hairdressing salon, where I met some of the most beautiful hairdressers and beauticians that I'm still friends with today. This was in 1991. And the wall had just come down in Berlin, and it was all extremely historic. And we did Russia and we did Amsterdam, and slowly, you know, I met the people that I wasn't supposed to meet, and I finally gave in to my cravings, and I ended up back on doing what I was, and not being able to get up to go to work. And they brought the, you know, the London office onto the ship one day, and they said to me, Fiona, have you got a problem? You know, you're the way, you know, you stay up at night and you make all this noise and you're loud and you're acting out and it's getting on people's nerves and you can't get to work on time. Have you got a problem? And I was like fuming. I was like, how dare they say, what have I got? A problem? How rude is that? I was so, so shocked. That, in 1991, I left. I ended up having to go back to England. I was still hankering about coming to live over to France. In France, I'd met this wonderful life over here with the fresh water that comes in from the mountains. And, you know, I lived in Lincolnshire, so it was flatland, and here was mountainous and green. And, you know, the horizon was, like, undulated. There were fig trees everywhere. You could just pick fruit off. And, oh, man, I was just, like, desperate to come and live over here and create myself a new life. So I did. I got chucked off the ship, and I really regret that, actually. I still have dreams about it now. I really wish that I knew then what I know today. And I ended up meeting a guy who with a guitar, and we ran away from England with 26 quid in our pockets, and we hitchhiked around Europe for 2 months. Which gave me an insight into life on the street. And we lived on the streets for a couple of months, and we tried to do jobs, you know, where we could make a bit of money. And we ended up scavenging, and we ended up living in the woods and in caves and at trade stations and all the kind of things that people do when they backpack. Until it got to a stage where I was like stuck. I was like, I couldn't get a job because I needed a place to, you know, an address, and I didn't have an address because I hadn't got a job to be at. And I was like in this situation where I was like, wow, how the hell does one get out of this situation in life, you know, all these eye-opening social experiences that I was having. I still believed that, you know, my life was going to be in France. I had to get back to France. There was at least a couple of people that I knew there, and I'd already babysat once, and I'd already been over and I'd grape picked once as well, and so the villagers knew who I was. So I came to France, and I found an old truck on the side of the road. There was nothing in it. It was completely empty. And so I lived in there for a while, like just stealing from the supermarkets and cooking on a wood fire outside and swimming in the river, cleaning myself in the rivers and washing my hair in the waterfalls and freezing. Sounds romantic, but freezing waterfall water is not fun, believe me, when you want to get a hair wash. It was an absolute necessity. And then the villagers started talking and saying, "Hey, there's this girl, this English girl who does babysitting." And a family came and fetched me. A woman came down. She left a note in my door last year. "I've got a 10-month-old daughter. You better get out of this truck and come and live with us in a caravan, and you can clean the house and look after the little baby." And that's where my life in France began in 1992. So that was a year I kicked off the ship. And yeah, I lived in a sculptor's house. I got like 12 quid a week, but I didn't want for anything. I was safe. I was away from England. I knew when I got to France that I wanted to live a spiritual life. I knew that I wanted to be bilingual. And I was just like an open book. I needed to learn a language. Looking after the little children gave me an opportunity to learn a language at the same speed as them. So I got into nannying and I travelled around with nannying. I went to Corsica and I went to Paris and Belgium in Brussels as well. And I had those kind of experiences after I'd met an Englishman. I met an English lad who was 21. And he was like, "Oh my God, you're English." And I'm like, "Go away. I'm not interested in English people. I just want to be French. I'm French. I'm pretending, to be this new persona." And he was really irritating, this lad. But he had a motorbike. He had a little mobilette. And I was like, "Oh, I'll be friends with him, while I get to, discover this area." And so, and he ticked all the boxes of the criteria I needed for a boyfriend. He had to be a smoker. He had to be doing the stuff that I like doing. And it all was good. So I met my soulmate, and I finally fell in love with him. And he had a flat in the town, so I moved out of the caravan from the sculptor's place, and I moved in with him. And then I was in paradise. I was just in love. Waking up every morning, looking out the window, thinking, "Oh my God, I'm still here. Oh my God, I'm still here." And I'm not only just here, I'm here with him. And we worked as a couple. I looked after children. He was a builder. And yeah, man, I was just in paradise. Best life. And we had our own flat. And then we decided to get a dog after 6 years of being together, and he was my engagement present, and learned to work the sheep. And life was just absolutely paradisical. It was wonderful until the birth of my first son. Well, I have one son, when he was 26 and I was 32. And just after he was born, he had a heart attack. And we had the doctor come and visit the house and say, she was pleading with him, saying, "You have to stop smoking. You have to stop smoking. You have heart disease. It's genetic. It's in the family. Please, if you want to save your life, you're going to have to stop smoking." And I sat at this boy's bedside and watched him suffer this heart attack. And this was the father of my newborn baby. And he got over it, but he never stopped. And as we know, the disease just escalates, and the smoking got more, and it got more, and it was 24 se it was just 24/7. And the more he worked for people that grew it, the more he brought home, and the more we had in the house. And I was a lightweight, I was just a total lightweight. I couldn't smoke cigarettes in the morning. They'd send me weird. I just couldn't cope with the trembling. We'd stop the alcohol, but I'd be smoking every evening. And I noticed one night when I put my son to bed that I put him to bed and I was tired and I was fed up and I was annoyed with my boyfriend for some reason. And I kind of plonked this baby down in his crib, really roughly. And I was shocked with myself. I was like, wow, whoa, wait a minute. Where the hell did that come from this, you know, this nurturing mother, this breastfeeding, nurturing, loving, caring mother with her first baby? There was this thread of aggression appeared. And I was like, wow, that must be, you know, something that I've inherited from my childhood. And so I went to the psychologist, of course, and I'm like, yeah, I've got a problem. I don't know what it is. I'm a bit aggressive around my children and I don't want to do this. I want to sort this out. And I told her about my boyfriend's 24/7 consummation. And she was like, you got to leave him. You just got to leave him. And so I left there and I thought, that's not the solution. That's not what's happening. So there I am trying to cope with me, trying to cope with being a young mom and trying to cope with a boyfriend, you know, 24/7, not emotionally available. And yeah, we then had our second child, and it just seemed like I was the only one trying to put any work into being, you know, clean and sober and trying to look after the children and, you know, as a clean person and give them the best of what I was. And I decided that this was it. I was gonna be clean. But I tried and I tried and I tried and I did the psychologist and I tried the patches and I tried the nicotine tablets and I tried the books and I tried everything and I'd stop and then I'd start and I'd stop. And I actually did my first step around a letter that I sent to my partner, and I was 30 years old, so this is 27 years ago, clean, saying to him, you know, I'm really sorry for the way I treat you and how negative I am, and how, you know, I was aware in this letter that I loved this man, but there was our connection was like distorted and I couldn't understand, I couldn't put my finger on it. And so, you know, my first step was all around the realization that this was the moment that I was wanting to be clean and I couldn't do it on my own and be around someone that was using. It wasn't happening for me. So I rang a helpline. And the lady that answered the phone was AA, and she was a counsellor. And for anybody that might be triggered, that I'm going to mention other fellowships, this is my story, and this is how it brought me to NA. So I had counselling with this lady. We both went, and she explained to me what addiction was about. And I was like, whoa, I don't really think that's me. And she was like, I said, look, he's the one that's got the problem. And she said, I can't do anything for him, but if you come and see me, we'll have a look at you. And she said, oh my God, Fiona, she said, you've got this, 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 this. She says, you want this better life, don't you? You know, you want this spiritual life you've been talking about. This is what you've got to do. And she told me I had to get clean, which meant I had to give up everything. I had to give up everything that was anything that might control, you know, the way I thought or the way I acted or anything, any substance that was my crutch, basically, to get through life. The thing that said, I don't give a damn, I'm just going to, you know, do that and everything's going to be fine. And so I did. I managed it with her, and she was absolutely amazing. It was the first time I'd ever opened myself up to anybody. And I thank her and I bless her life today. And she carried me through my pink cloud. I was then on a tangent because my partner wasn't clean and I was, and I'd got help and he'd been to see the same therapist and he was supposed to give up the same stuff, especially seeing as he'd had a previous heart attack. And she sat me down one day and she said, you know what, Fiona, the way your partner's going, he's going to end up having another heart attack and he'll probably die. And I just remember we were doing a meditation and I just emptied my whole body of tears. And I just had this puddle in between my, you know, knees where I was sitting in the cross leg position. And I believed what she said. I believed her and I trusted her because she brought me to a place that I'd wished where I wanted to be for so long. And it was working with her. So anyway, my life, yeah, in France was starting to get a bit heavy. We were on two different planes, and the more I saw him struggle to join me, the stronger I got, because I joined another fellowship. This fellowship helps members of families and friends of alcoholics understand the disease of alcoholism and how to live with them and how to appreciate them and how to love them and how to live side by side in peace with these people that are in the grips of alcoholism. His disease had switched onto extreme heavy drinking, and it was the same as my heroin boyfriend. Everything was hidden from me. I don't know whether they do it out of respect or whether they do it out of guilt or shame or what, but they both behaviors was exactly the same. I never ever once saw him pick up a drink. And yet when he walked through the door, I would never know what state he would be in. And it was frightening. It was absolutely frightening. And I was with this fellowship for 5 years, and I did a lot of service, and they carried me through right until the day he died of his third heart attack. He had a second one when he was building our house for us, as that took him to hospital, and he nearly lost his life. And the third one took him away in 2018. So I, you know, was left with the two children and the struggling to stay clean, and knowing that it was my best life, and knowing that there were the fellowships, and I'd been to a convention. We'd been invited with Al-Anon. I was invited to an AA convention, and I celebrated my sobriety, because I'd been sober for many, 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 many years. And I'd heard about, the NA in these fellowships. It was a chain event. It was, an AA client of mine who told me about Al-Anon, who put me in touch with, AA, and I heard their stories that was shocking, but they were real, and it was what was happening in my life. And then I'd heard about NA, and I thought to myself, I'm not an alcoholic. I know I'm not an alcoholic. The alcohol's not my thing. I know it's not. I've been sober like 17 years, and I thought, I probably need NA. I'll give it. I was petrified, absolutely petrified, to think that I was going to have to admit that I might have a problem with drugs, So I asked a girlfriend to come with me to a meeting, and we did. And the guy on the phone said, "We have dinner afterwards, and you can come with us to the restaurant, and it'll be nice." And I'm like, "Whoa, let's go!" So I went, and I had the company of my girlfriend, and I could relate to what the people were saying, and I could understand what being a scapegoat in the family dynamic was all about. And so I came away from there with a lot on my plate. I had a house to sell. I had a salubrious house to empty. My father had died, and I left the home, and I brought the children with me to small town, and I lived in a tiny weeny little 38 square meter flat. A bit like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the beginning of the film, when the family's all sleeping in the same bed. I wanted that. I wanted closeness. I wanted not to be like I was as a child, and my parents not knowing what I was doing when I was like really abusing myself as a very young. I was a child. I wasn't even an adult. I was 16. So I didn't want that for my children. I'd learnt about the disease of addiction. I'd learnt about its progression. I'd also lived by it and experienced it full on, not only personally, but also, with the death of my partner. And I'd I decided to join a local meeting, which I went to, and it was all in French. And so, of course, I followed it a bit, tried to understand it a bit, and because I'd been in the previous fellowships, I knew how they worked. But this was all about me now. This was my turn, you know. This was my turn to get Fiona clean, to get her stable, so that she could then be this mother that, you know, the children could depend on. And also in the grace and the light of the work that my partner and I had both done together on trying to get clean, both of us at the same time, which we had a very small window in our lives where we were both clean together. And we were like, we can do this. We can do this. Let's do this together. You know, I'd left him and he got clean, and he came to the flat, and I said, hey, you know, there's this beautiful person, this person that, you know, I absolutely loved with all my heart, standing there clean. And there's me clean. We decided that, you know, we could do it. And I moved back in the house, and the therapist said to me, that's the worst thing you could have done, Fiona. And that's when everything, you know, just seriously went downhill. So, yeah, I'm in my flat. I've got my two children with me. We're living basically on top of each other, everybody. They were, you know, you're in the bathroom, you can talk to somebody in the other bedroom, you can talk to somebody in the living room. We were just like always together, always together. Their friends came over. They were teenagers. I lived near the two schools, near the secondary school, and then there were buses. They became independent, and all this time I'm in and out and in and out, being clean and then picking up and being clean and picking up and being clean and picking up, and oh God, not being able to be stable, and just hating myself for looking at my children when I'm not clean. I'm thinking, oh my God, you just don't understand. I can't do this. I can't do this. I want to do something I can't do. So I was going to these meetings in French, and an ex-boyfriend of mine called me on Facebook and said, hey, you fancy meeting up? And this was my ex-heroin addict boyfriend, and I thought, wow, this is like 25 years later. I'd be really interested to see what he's like, and I'm clean, I'm in NA. And they said to me, Fiona, you're taking a risk, this is not advisable, you know, you're 10 months clean, you need to not be getting yourselves involved in emotional relationships. It's going to be derogatory to your clean time. And I was like, you don't know me, you know, I'm so strong. Anyway, cut a long story short, we had an absolute magic time until we didn't. And there's me like back out for about another 2 years. And I'm thinking, oh God, I don't want to do this. I must find a way to do this in the most real way possible. Really, if it's going to be a spiritual experience, I need to do this in my own language. And I thought to myself, I need to do it at home. You know, my children had grown up, they'd left home, I was on my own. I thought, I'm comfortable at home, you know, I like being, I've got my dogs, I've got my job, I've got everything's going fine. What about online? And so I went onto the computer and I just put online recovery. And up came this group in America, and it was at midnight, I think. It was when I was staying up late, and I plugged into this meeting, and there I got a sponsor, and I started doing the steps, and they sent me boxes of literature, and they just picked me up, and they just grabbed hold of me, and they didn't let me go. And they said, look, girl, we know exactly what you've been through. Hear our stories. I heard their stories. I was like, oh my God, how can this be true that they're getting through this life, you know? And I did. I emptied myself again through tears, and I healed myself in recovery. And I've been through a couple of sponsors that have been in England, and the times are more suited to my schedule now, that I go to bed at a decent time and I get up at a decent time. And I finally got settled, and I'm in my second year online. I got clean online. I did my 90-90. For anybody that's new, it's 90 meetings in 90 days, which I did. I really disciplined myself to make sure that I really put this recovery into practice. And I live on my own. My children are grown. My partner's deceased. I have all this experience behind me about the disease of addiction. There was no reason why, for 1 minute, I could not come out of denial in my step one and say, "Look, Fiona, you suffer from the disease of addiction. You have obsessive compulsive behavior. You want to escape. You want to you don't want to face these feelings. You just want to disappear and isolate and this kind of stuff." So there's all sorts of reasons why, I carry on with NA. My step two, so my first step, I did in a different way. I did it through this beautiful letter that I wrote to my partner. My step two gave me the hope that I never had. I came into NA without any hope. I hoped that my partner was going to get clean. I hoped that he was never going to die. I hoped that his heart was never going to fail him. I hoped that my children were going to always, that we were always going to live together and get old together. I had so much hope. I really did. I hoped that the love that I'd lost from my father, as his alcoholism increased and his anger increased towards me, and my hatred increased towards him, I had hope that with the practice of the program that I would be able to do something about that, and I did. My father's behavior towards me when I'm clean was completely different, because it's these tools of acceptance and no matter what, and it's not my stuff, it's his stuff, and he's not going to press buttons because these buttons in me don't exist anymore. I can just let go, and I can let God. I can just allow somebody their own persona and not take it on board and think that it's mine. And so, because of my behavior changing, my father's behavior changed, and we managed to do a full circle in our relationship. And just before he died, after the death of my mother, he died after my mom. We were just like we were when I was that adored little child again. He adored me. He celebrated me. He congratulated me. He was proud of me. And I did him right by getting clean. That's what I did. And because I was clean, so he realized that his behaviors weren't acceptable, and I told him that they weren't, as he was with me when I was younger, and his heavy hand and his rejection and barring me out of the property and taking keys off me and basically turning me into a homeless person and me having to knock on my front door and beg to be let in the house and stuff. I probably wasn't the nicest personality at all, because I wouldn't be coming home sober. So, I do recognize my part in that too. And he died, and my heart was just full of love for him, and that is just priceless. It was just a gift. I didn't expect that at all by getting clean, that this relationship would turn out to be as beautiful and as forgiving and as loving as it, and it was. So yeah, the hope that I found in step two has been rekindled again. I do have hope today. I can give myself hope. I can allow myself to have hope. I can allow myself to have faith. I can allow myself to believe in a spiritual guide and have a higher power, and it's not all me. It's my choice. It's our choice in this program to decide what we want to take from it, how we want to live our lives clean. And we have options. We say we have options. There's so much in the literature. There's so much to, there's no way I could ever get bored, you know, in reading. I've got things like Addiction Thrives in Negativity. It's just philosophy for me. It's like addiction thrives in negativity. So what's the solution? Just, Fiona, don't be like, be anything but negative. If you can be as clean now as you want to be, and you can live without being negative, then you're going to be furthest from addiction than you know you could ever be, which is what I want to happen. Thanks, Steve. I don't know when you sent me that, but so yeah, everybody, I'm looking at the time, and I started at 12, so I have done more than 45 minutes. I just want to say thank you to everybody for listening, and thank you to our predecessors. Thank you for the program, and I'll leave it there.